Welcome to Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Women have had a love-hate relationship with footwear since time immemorial, and nothing brings that home more than an exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum, aptly titled Killer Heels, The Art of the High-Heeled Shoe, which runs through mid-February. It features more than 160 pieces of footwear, from traditional Chinese Manchu platforms to black high-heeled dinner Oxfords of the early 1900s to Christian Louboutin's 2007 8-inch high leather stilettos that, if ever worn, would force a woman's feet into a ballerina's on-point position. This stunning, fascinating, and jaw-dropping exhibition is curated by my guest today. In its review, the New York Times wrote, meticulously assembled by Lisa Small, the museum's curator of exhibitions, the show is a labor of love and erudition. Beautiful colors, exotic materials, and stunning craftsmanship abound. And Ms. Small's extended labels add useful facts and observations. Some useful facts about Lisa Small. She joined the Brooklyn Museum in 2011 and was the coordinating curator for its hugely popular exhibit, The Fashion World of Jean-Paul Gaultier, From the Sidewalk to the Catwalk, and Jean-Michel Atoniel, My Way. From 2007 to 2011, Lisa was curator of exhibitions at the American Federation of Arts in Manhattan, coordinating travel exhibitions. Before joining the AFA, Lisa worked as a curator at the Dehesh Museum of Art in Lower Manhattan, where she organized numerous exhibitions. She has taught art history at Manhattan's Hunter College, Brooklyn College, and the School of Visual Arts. Lisa, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with feet. What was the catalyst for getting Killer Heels off the ground?
Well, actually, it started from the perspective of film, because, as you know, there are also six commissioned films in the exhibition. And about 3 years ago, one of the filmmakers who ultimately made one of the films came to our director and said, I've been doing a lot of work on this idea of fashion film. You know, the fact that so many designers these days are working with filmmakers and other, visual people to make these short films about their brands. It's a burgeoning genre. Wouldn't it be great if you did a show, about that featured some of that work and we could center it around high heels? And, we were kind of taken with that idea, but as a museum, we wanted to also bring objects into the mix. And the Brooklyn Museum has a long history of costume collection, which is now had been transferred to the Costume Institute at the Metropolitan. So we wanted to do that. So it sort of evolved from there. So I always like to start out by saying that I wish I could say that,
it was all me
and it was something that I'd been thinking of since I was a little girl. And I love high heels. I love fashion. But it sort of evolved, in that sideways kind of way.
Well, and how did you get involved with that?
Well, because at the Brooklyn Museum, as you said, my title is curator of exhibitions. I work in our exhibitions division. There are three curators in that division. And unlike the curators that are collection curators, for the Egyptian collection or the European paintings collection, we are curators that work when, for instance, we take a show that was organized elsewhere, like the Gaultier exhibition that you mentioned, and we have to be the on-staff sort of coordinating curator. Sometimes that just means sort of shepherding the show through our own system. Sometimes, as in the case of the Jean-Michel Atoniel show, I added some pieces to that show, made it slightly different for Brooklyn. And sometimes we can take on projects where we do organize and curate our own exhibitions, particularly if they're in areas that aren't a part of our collections anymore, like costume and fashion. So that's sort of how I came to it. And I think of the three curators in our exhibitions division, because I wear high heels a lot.
Well, I happen to notice you're wearing flats.
I am wearing flats today because I'm doing a lot of walking after this.
So for all intents and purposes, you really gave birth to this exhibit.
I did. Once it came, came together that we were going to do the show, I was the curator. And, of course, no show happens at the Brooklyn Museum all from one person.
Right.
I worked with, extraordinary people on staff and off, but it was my show to organize.
So take us through
what that must be like. What's step one?
Well, you know, step one is, you know, for me anyway, you know, you sort of think about what the narrative of the show is going to be. You know, what do you want to be saying to people? What do you want them to look at? And the way I work, you know, that's how I would first come to begin to generate a checklist, right? Because the show is about the objects. And so you have your subject and you think, well, what are the best ways to express what I'm thinking about? And for me, there were a couple of things that loomed very large right at the beginning that I knew that I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted to incorporate historical material because at the outset, when we were speaking about the show, very initial conversations were all about all contemporary shoes, you know, current high heels, mm-hmm. sort of a snapshot of the current landscape, I guess. But for me, because, you know, I'm an art historian and I like, you know, historical investigation, and because we did have this important collection that contained many fabulous historical shoes from the Brooklyn Museum costume collection, I wanted to bring that historical dimension into the show. So that was the—
So that was right in your own backyard. Yeah. You didn't have to do anything with that.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, we had that collection and we, you know, have an extremely collegial relationship with the Metropolitan. You know, they were extraordinarily generous, not just with the Brooklyn Museum costume collection, which is housed there, but also items from the Costume Institute collection as well that are on loan to us. So I knew that I wanted a historical dimension. I also knew that I wanted to, you know, for a lot of people, and I realized this right away when I was beginning to talk about it, when you say, you know, high heels, people think stiletto. That's what they think,
sure.
because that's sort of, you know, the archetypal form. But also, I was thinking about elevation, height, however the shoe gets there, meaning that I wanted to include platform shoes, wedge shoes, you know, sort of what I consider to be the three iterations, I guess, in a way. So in other words, not just the separated heel, the stiletto, but rather platforms, you know, and the wedge form as well.
Are platforms the oldest form of shoe?
Platforms, indeed, are the oldest form of elevated shoe.
Of elevated shoe.
Exactly.
And why did they come to be?
Well, you know, they have their roots in a number of different cultures, and there are some common threads about why they came to be. But a lot of it circles around issues either of, well, I mean, if you think about Japanese culture, the geta, some of which became very elevated, we have an example of a super high geta in our show, you know, emerged from shoes that farmers wore in the fields in the wet rice paddies to keep their feet dry, you know,
right.
high and dry. So there is an element of avoidance of the dirt and
practicality.
Practicality, I guess, if you will. But a lot of it also has to do with notions of prestige, of status, of kind of the, you know, almost reductive way that the higher you are, the more elevated your status is.
Even
you know?
If you're a woman?
Well, you know, yes. I mean, the platform the platform goes back over 2,000 years. We have an amazing photograph reproduction in our exhibition of a tiny statue of Aphrodite from the first century BC, and she's wearing a pair of enormous platform shoes. You know, they were associated early on, in that case, clearly with the goddess of love, mm-hmm. with a female form.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in Roman times, actors wore them on the stage. There was a particular kind of platform shoe that tragic actors, men
would
wear
exactly.
on stage,
right?
And you know, it's thought that you know that had to do with the more important the character was, the higher and more visible they'd be on the stage with the platform shoe. So the platform shoe is the oldest, and it goes back. And you know, as the great scholar of high heel shoes, Elizabeth Semmelhack, you know, of the Bata Shoe Museum, has pointed out, you know, we may never be able to absolutely untangle the various tangents and threads of how high heels came to be. But we know that they are strongly associated with leisure, with power, with privilege, with upper classes.
With sexiness?
Well, you know, certainly now, but that's a whole other interesting tale of how that came to be. Because if you're talking about Western high heels in the West, they sort of entered Western fashion around the end of the 16th century, you know, late 1500s.
That long ago.
Yes, that long ago. And they were almost definitely first worn by men. So high heels in the West was men's fashion in its first, you know, introduction into the fashion system in the West. That's because around that time, you know, there was a lot of contact with the East, with Persia, you know, between military operations, mm-hmm. trading, and so forth. And heeled boots and shoes had a long tradition as equestrian footwear for reasons that are, I think, become kind of obvious when you think about it. It's like cowboy boots today. They have that wedge heel because it helps keep your foot in the stirrups when you're on a horse. And so the Westerners saw this. And of course, there's always been a craze for things Eastern, you know, exotic. Mm-hmm. There was the whiff of the exotic around this.
Sure.
And they were highly masculine. You know, these were soldiers, mounted soldiers wearing these heeled boots. Mm-hmm. And so men wore them. They adopted them into Western dress, aristocrats associated with horsemanship and keeping horses and other wealthy pursuits. And then as now, women's fashion takes a lot of its cues from menswear. And so very soon after, women adopted the heeled shoe as well. And then it's a whole other issue about the transformation to having become an extremely gendered form of footwear as it is now, you know, going back to your point about sexy.
The opening section of the exhibit is revival and reinterpretation, and it focuses on, quote, constant recycling of conventions and forms through time and cultures, as in everything old is new again.
Exactly. And I say as much in the label. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I never throw anything out. That's one of the morals of this story.
So shoes equal sculpture?
Well, actually, in developing this checklist, one of my main criteria was I was looking for shoes that had a kind of sculptural dimension that were, you know, in some way innovative or striking, you know, as an iteration of this form of the high-heeled shoe. You know, it turns out that there's quite a lot that different designers do between that space between the ground and the sole of the foot, whether it's a platform, whether it's through embellishment or kind of interesting structural solutions to that issue. So I was primarily looking for those kinds of forms.
But I guess the thing that strikes me is that it's called Killer Heels.
Yes.
Why?
Yes. That's the kind of title that we knew that people would bring their own meaning to that. You mm-hmm. know, we like that kind of flexibility that people, you know, hear what they want to hear or understand it the way they want to understand it, which is fabulous. And a lot of people say killer heels. It's because you can't walk in them, you'll kill yourself, and, you know, all of that. And there is that element of that. You know, we wanted the title that sort of conjured these various sides of the coin. So there's that, you know, killer heel. There's clearly the association with danger and weaponry. I mean, that goes right to the fact that stiletto, as we call that form of heel, is the word, you know, in Italian for a dagger, mm-hmm. a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that whole discourse about the shoe as weapon. But then there's also, you know, think about the phrase killer these days. How do people use that now? They're like, I got this killer app
Hot,
on my
amazing.
Phone. Exactly.
Yes.
You know, it does everything. It's just, you know, the perfect version of what I need. And mm-hmm. so there's that kind of positive, powerful connotation to it as well. So we felt naturally it was catchy. And, you know, and that's important in a museum exhibition title, let's be honest. But it did have these shades of different meanings.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Lisa Small, curator of exhibitions at the Brooklyn Museum and the woman responsible for Killer Heels, the Art of the High-Heeled Shoe. You know, it's really funny because I went to this exhibit, as I've said. I loved it. I really appreciated it, but it didn't talk to me necessarily, if you know what I mean. My version of a killer heel is, what, about an inch and a half or whatever. Of course, and as you're going through it and your jaw's dropping when it's the, you know, the shoes for the bound Asian women or whatever. What were you thinking when you were putting it together? Could you relate to your own exhibit?
Well, yes, because, you know, in full disclosure, I wear high-heeled shoes. I wore them before I even, you know, started working on this exhibition at all. I wore them throughout, and I'll continue to wear them. Although I will say, in moderation, I'm not a everyday, all-day high heel wearer.
Mm-hmm.
You can see I'm wearing flats today. So, you know, it spoke to me in the sense that as a woman, you know, who wears these shoes, I could step back and think, you know, well, why do I wear them?
Why do you wear them?
Well, you know, because I, you know, the ones that I like, I think they're beautiful objects. And I think, you know, whether you want to argue, and it is a whole other conversation, whether it's culturally sort of projected upon me as a woman in this society, I think they make the line of your body and certain clothes, you know, look elegant and streamlined. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, they change your carriage and your posture, and you have to be very aware of the way you hold yourself and you walk. You know, so I guess in that conventional sense, you know, for me, it's less about overt, you know, sexiness than just sort of the whole line of your body, you know, that line of beauty, I guess.
Do you feel comfortable wearing high-heeled shoes?
For a certain period of time, and again, like anything else, there are high-heeled shoes that are more or less comfortable, you know, depending on how they're made and constructed. I tend personally to divide my shoes into, I define them in terms of amounts of time. There are 30-minute shoes. There are, you know, two-hour shoes. So I do say that when I was younger, I used to actually wear them to work, you know, on the subway, on the pavement, you know, whatever. These days, they're in my bag and I bring them out at work.
So. And you wear them for you.
Yes.
And meaning that nobody is telling you, you know, that you don't feel that you're having to go by convention to wear these shoes.
No, because, you know, as I said, I mean, I wear what I want to wear on any given day. And some days that involves flats. Some days that involves sneakers. And some days that involves high heels. I think it depends on what I'm feeling like that day, what else I'm wearing, what I want to wear, and what I think works. So I look at it as just another, you know, another part of the array of sartorial choices that you have.
Ooh, nicely put. Nicely put.
As a modern woman.
Were you very surprised at the reaction that this show engendered? I know you must feel very proud, but...
Well, I'm very happy. And, you know, maybe a little element of a surprise, because let's put it this way. I knew that this show, by virtue simply of its topic, was going to automatically attract a wide audience because there are so many people who love shoes. You know, they...
But what about the male part, if I might interrupt? Were you surprised by that?
The men who come see the show?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I was pleasantly surprised,
but
I kind of...
Are they there for the fetish part of it?
Well, you know, we're not taking a poll at the beginning, so there may be some who are coming for that reason. But as I mentioned before, because I was talking a lot or trying to talk a lot about history and the role of the high heel in at different points in time in different cultures, I knew, and because we were really, so many of the shoes emphasize this sort of sculptural or architectural or really visually rich and astonishing range, I knew that it would have appeal, you know, speaking stereotypically to a man or someone that was not someone, you know, who was wearing shoes every day and obsessing over the new, you know, fashions, but rather just somebody who could enjoy it visually for the historical insights that they might come away from it with. Mm-hmm. And so I was pleased by that. You know,
you don't have to be a fashionista to go to this exhibit.
No, in fact, that's my point. What I'm trying to get to is that we knew fashionistas would come and that most would really enjoy it, but you don't have to be. You know, you can be interested in design. Just as a broad discipline. In fact, one of the interesting things that we ended up doing in the show, I was working closely, of course, with our amazing chief designer at the museum, Matthew Yokoboski, who designed the entire installation. And we selected, I went through our collections, because the Brooklyn Museum has encyclopedic collections, as you know, about 25 objects ranging from teacups and candlesticks to tables and furniture, and created these little vignettes with some of the heels in the show to sort of further contextualize this idea of the shoe as an object that is participating in wider kind of design trends or can be seen to be influenced or participating.
Right. That does have an influence.
Exactly.
That's amazing.
Exactly.
Did you ever feel with this that you were in over your head?
Is that a pun?
Take it for whatever way you want.
Well, you know, at the beginning I did, you know, you always, when you're going to put something out there that you have to get behind as your work, there's always a sense of trepidation and nervousness. For me, it was really because this was, at the end of the day, I mean, it was about an object of fashion, an icon of fashion, an iconic object. And I am not a fashion person. I don't come from a background of being a costume historian or a fashion historian. I don't come from a background of being, you know, deeply enmeshed in the contemporary fashion world. I follow fashion as
which is interesting because you were responsible for the Gaultier exhibit also.
Well, I was responsible. Yes, I was the coordinating curator for it. You know, when it came to our museum. But again, I think that's you know because I expressed an interest in fashion. I guess you know, but. On the one hand, though, when you're working with a museum exhibition, there are certain things, despite the subject matter of the exhibition, just have to be done, and mm-hmm. there's sort of a way to go about it. But so, yes, I was a little concerned because I thought, well, you know, the real fashion people are going to, you know, there'll definitely be someone who said, well, why didn't you include this shoe?
Of course.
Why didn't you include
this
shoe? And why didn't you include this shoe? And, you know, so I sort of kept saying to myself, well, a show like this, honestly, like any art exhibition almost, could be curated in a number of different ways. You know, different objects could come in and make different points. But this was my take on it. And, you know, that's how I went.
And you flushed it out really well. I mean, by virtue of the fact that there are six short films, that's unusual. Also, there's that fetish section. What stone was left unturned? None, intents and purposes, right?
I feel like we covered a lot of bases. And you know, that was another thing that was important to me early on in the conceptualization of the show was that I knew that I didn't want to do a straightforward, it wasn't going to be a full history of the high heel shoe. So mm-hmm. I didn't want it to be organized chronologically or if we had, you know, in some cases we have more than one shoe from a particular designer. I didn't want it to be by designer, you know, all the shoes by designer
sure.
X be together. I knew that I wanted to organize it thematically and then look at these shoes across categories. So that was also a kind of foundational point for me. It turned out to embrace kind of, I think, it touched the notes I wanted to touch on.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Lisa Small, curator of exhibitions at the Brooklyn Museum and the woman responsible for Killer Heels, the Art of the High-Heeled Shoe. Did you always aspire to be a curator? is this your dream job?
Define always. You know, I think that... I mean, I'm so happy to be doing it now.
You're doing a lot of great things in the 3 years that you've been at Brooklyn.
Well, the Brooklyn Museum is a really exciting place to be. You know, it's always been on the cutting edge. It tries different things. You know, it's a really exciting place to be with wonderful colleagues to work with. I mean, you know, I started out, honestly, and this is kind of funny based on what I just said. I was a fine arts major, double major English and fine arts in college. But my first job out of college, all I wanted to do was work in the fashion world. That's my secret. And I started by working at Bloomingdale's in the executive training program.
Well, that's not so unusual.
To be a buyer.
Okay.
You know? And mm-hmm. I quickly realized that the world of retail, and I don't know whether this is specific to fashion, but I think it might be, was a very, you know, it had a kind of a, I wasn't cut out for it.
Okay.
Let's just say that,
mm-hmm.
you know. And ultimately, I made my way back to graduate school and, you know, realized that I was more interested in thinking about objects and interpreting objects and, you know, I think also translating, trying to convey, and this is where I love teaching too, that comes into it, kind of helping people discover things, you know, breaking things down, I guess, for people so that, you know, they get some insight and maybe next time they go to a museum, they'll say, oh, you know, I remember hearing about this
sort
of thing.
Sure. So, making it accessible
making
to people.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's mm-hmm. what I'm grasping for. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do a good job of making that thought accessible.
Don't worry about it. So then lead from fashion to art.
Well, so, you know, I worked at Bloomingdale's for a brief time.
So you got a discount there, and then you said, I got to get
yes,
out of here.
Yes, I did. And I thought, you know, when I hauled up, you know, yet another shipment from Italy, from the bowels of Bloomingdale's, where the rats, you know, I don't know if there are rats there anymore, but I thought, well, you know, this isn't quite the glamour world that I thought it would be. You know, so I went back to graduate school. First, I went to NYU, and I got a master's degree in arts administration, because interestingly, I kind of was skirting around the issue of going full-on graduate school, like the PhD. So I was thinking more about, you know, quote-unquote practical matters,
mm-hmm.
you know, arts administration. But then, you know, the more I got into it, the more I realized, you know, hey, I really do like doing research and writing papers and that sort of thing. So I, you know.
And you don't mind the solitariness of it, do you?
No, in fact, I like that.
I've heard this from several women I've interviewed who are curators, and they love that.
Some of my happiest memories of that time are sitting in the beautiful reading room of the Frick Art Reference Library, just all afternoon, and it's so genteel of a place. If you've ever been there, they bring your books to you, what you need, and you sit there and just being immersed in that, reading, mm-hmm. thinking, you know, no chatter. So, yes, I love that. So I went back finally. I went to the graduate school, graduate center, City University of New York, and entered the PhD program there, and went all the way through. My area of specialty is actually 19th century European art, and did everything except I did not write my dissertation. So I don't think I'll ever be Dr. Small.
Do you care?
I care in the sense of that bit of closure. Like, it would be nice.
Well, I mean, you always could.
Yeah, I guess I always could. But, you know, things intervened, had a kid, mm-hmm. you know,
sure.
was working. And
sure.
I know that has not stopped many, many other women from doing it. But, you know,
Whatever. So what was your first museum job?
Well, I think the one that I was the most significant was actually the one that I ended up staying in the longest. And it was a really fortunate experience for me, which was when I was in graduate school for art history, I started a part-time job as a researcher at what was then a brand new and very idiosyncratic museum in New York called the Dahesh Museum.
You know, I have to confess that when I was doing some research on you, and I'm, basically a New Yorker for most of my life, I never.
Well, it does not surprise me in the least. As I said, idiosyncratic is really, I don't even know if that is a word that encompasses what I really mean by idiosyncratic. You know, it was a collection, and it still exists as a collection. They don't have a museum space in New York anymore, that really was about the collecting tastes of one man who was very interested in academic painting of the 19th century. I'm talking Bouguereau, Cabanel, the very highly finished, highly polished, based on, you know, the classical tradition of learning anatomy and learning how to draw mm-hmm. the human body, history painting, and so forth. So it had an extremely idiosyncratic focus, but it was 19th century, and it was a research-based, position. And I started as a graduate student very early on, and I literally, and this is, it turned out to be such a blessing for me, because it was here in New York City, grew with the museum, and I eventually became a curator there. You know, I was with the museum for 12 years.
Wow.
And we worked on some really amazing projects that I'm very proud of. And even though it was a very small museum and, it's easy to get lost in the vastness of the New York City art world, museum world, toward the end, we did some very important shows. We borrowed very frequently from the Musée d'Orsay, from the Louvre, from the Met. We were doing the kinds of shows that were really important that no one else would have done.
So that's where you really cut your teeth.
Yeah, I think so. And, because as a small, very, family-centric museum, there came a time when for various reasons, it was not tenable really anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought,
it's time to move.
It's time to move. And by that time, I really didn't want to, and I was teaching throughout all this time too, and I didn't really want to leave New York City because, who does? And this position at the AFA, the American Federation of Arts, came up. And I thought, I love doing exhibitions. I love, at that point, being a generalist and possibly having the idea to have a hand in exhibitions that are not even in my area of expertise.
Right, that could be 20th century
right,
painting.
Working with other curators, mm-hmm, and it was also a wonderful learning experience. They're a great organization. They have shows that are traveling all over the country. And then after about 4 or so years there, I thought, again, I like having a collection, I like, because the AFA, it's not a museum, so it doesn't have its own collection.
Mm-hmm.
It has the benefit of partnering with museums all over the world, so you get exposed that way. But I thought, back at a museum where there's one collection that you can sort of get to know, and or one place whose mission and whose brand and whose, way of connecting with an audience you can, kind of work with. You're not always all over the place.
And when you joined Brooklyn, you were also given that option, right? Because it's so large. There's an eclecticism.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Brooklyn Museum's collection is global.
For you, I mean.
Yes. And for, mm-hmm. and for me, I mean, and the thing about it was is that after having worked at the AFA for 4 years, the position at Brooklyn, because it was in the exhibitions division, as a curator of exhibitions, the whole kind of program, it was a perfect sort of segue for me because it allowed me to continue to work primarily on exhibitions as opposed to being a collections curator, which becomes also about maintaining the collection and new acquisitions and things like that, and allowed me again to continue to do what I like, which is, to work on a variety, as you say, of different projects, different eras, different styles.
So if I was your fairy godmother, would you say to me, you don't have to, I'm fine here, I like what I'm doing, or is there a fantasy that you have of working somewhere without having to leave New York, of course?
You know, it's not so much the fantasy of a specific place. I guess I would love the opportunity, once again, to work on a show that was more closely related somehow to what was originally in my wheelhouse most, you know, and whether, you know, something 18th, 19th century, you know, painting, print, something like that. And that may, I may still have an opportunity to do that, you know, at Brooklyn. So, no, I don't think I'd need to, I think that the culture and the people at the Brooklyn Museum are such that it's really a wonderful place to work. So,
so you're happy.
I'm happy.
And you're going nowhere. Well, yeah. We have to go somewhere because we've run out of time. Lisa, it was such an enjoyable conversation.
Yeah,
I learned a lot.
Yeah, and it was wonderful.
And that you can sit back and kind of rest on your laurels with this show, which has just gotten so much terrific press. It was really great to meet you, and lots of luck.
You too. Thank you so much.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.